Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Kyle Hopkins of the Anchorage Daily News, and Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. Steve, Governor Parnell takes out his veto pen and takes it to the state budget. What did he veto, and what was his philosophy in approaching these vetoes?
Well, first of all, he had a lot of nice things to say about the legislature, which is kind of a switch. He credited them for staying within his confines for the budget. He had vetoed the two previous years' record amounts. I think it was in 2010 he vetoed like $300 million out of the budget. And that was a record for vetoes at the time. Then he upped himself the year afterwards by vetoing $400 million out of that. And this time around, it was just $67 million. So he gave credit to lawmakers for heeding his warning about having an extra large budget in times of declining oil revenues. And lawmakers seemed to heed his call, and they stuck within his guidelines. So the programs, though, that saw reductions, kind of make you cringe when you hear about them. There was substance abuse programs, early childhood development programs, pre-kindergarten programs. They're the ones who saw the reductions.
Can you explain the substance abuse programs? Because that seems to me to go directly to the heart of show respect.
That's one of the cornerstones of his administration, isn't it? He basically, for all of these programs, they're all getting an increase this year. He just sort of reduced the amount of increases. So they're all seeing an increase.
That would be his argument.
Yes, that would be his argument. One of the programs, I don't know if it was a substance abuse one now, I think it might have been one of the pre-kindergarten development course programs, that he felt that they hadn't figured out yet what direction they were going to go in with this particular program, what it was going to do yet, where they wanted to sink their money in, so he cut a way back on the increase there. He said we need to study this further. And as far as the substance abuse program, I'm still not sure what the reasoning was behind cutting that. But again, I think it saw somewhat of an increase anyways from the past year. The moose relocation effort was another one. He had a
That's
problem.
One that's certainly always going to get the public's attention.
That's right. And his problem was that they wanted to include a relocation of adult moose. And he said, well, Fish and Game doesn't know what kind of an impact that would have on adult moose. So he says we should need to study that more. So it kind of ratcheted them down too. Also, there was one more cut that kind of flew under the radar. It was about $3 million for the Coastal Zone Management Program, which of course right now there isn't one. And he took that out of there. There's a ballot initiative that folks are trying to get, that I think it's on the August ballot. So,
what was his legislators assuming the ballot proposition was going to pass?
I think he feels that, well, there's no program right now, so why do you need the money? But he is prepared to put it back in should this ballot initiative pass in August.
Okay. So, Kyle Hopkins, you had a big story on the local eating and drinking establishment Rum Runners. The story focused on the world of bouncers and how they are regulated or not regulated, as really the case is. Tell us more about Rum Runners and what you learned there.
Sure. I think, the story I wrote was just a little bit of a closer look at what happened, the incident that led to criminal charges against a Rum Runners bouncer. And what was more important about the case is not just against the bouncer, but against the company that owns Rum Runners, and that's what's unusual. You know, it's not unusual for someone to get in trouble, you know, to get charged with assault for hurting somebody else. What's unusual is for their employer to get in trouble. And so it was kind of a statement being made by the prosecutors that, at least according to the defense, that the defense feels like that police and the prosecutors are overreaching their bounds by saying, you know what, it's not only the bouncer's fault, it's the boss's fault too. And so the story was, with that context in mind, just taking a look at, okay, so what happened that night, and more importantly, like, what else has happened? You know, is there a pattern there?
And remind us, what happened to the person who was, or the man who was injured?
Well, if you ask police, what happened is there was a guy who was drunk, not, you know, he says that he could, too drunk to drive, you know, but...
I was walking out.
He said, he admits he was drunk, right? And he was arguing. I mean, in each of these cases, it's like, it's kind of a gray line, but he admits that he was drunk. He was arguing with somebody. He is escorted out, or he's told to leave. There's some kind of confrontation. He punches one of the bouncers, and he says, "Yeah, I hit the bouncer in the jaw." And then what happens next is kind of where everything falls apart, because the bouncers, you know, he claims that they jump on him and they rough him up a little bit outside of the bar. They handcuff him, and then he claims that they take him to a room and just kind of proceed to beat him up. And keep beating him until he says that he's not going to press charges. You know, yeah. he says that, you know, I told him I wouldn't press charges, and that's when they kind of stopped. It's important to note that the bar says that we don't know exactly what happened, but nothing criminal happened. They just flatly deny all the charges. What's interesting is the police investigated. The police served some search warrants and then started filing charges. You know, they charged the bar with the assault. So not only the guy gets charged with assault, the bar gets charged with assault, and also the bar is charged with tampering with evidence. And I understand that means that there's some missing, you know, maybe just a few seconds of missing surveillance.
The tape was
the
edited.
Tape. Where's the tape? Right. And so, you know, there was the initial story that came out, and then we just kind of, you know, you hear from other people say, "Oh, that happened to me." And some of those, and that kind of always happens when you write a story like that. But there was just there were enough similarities in the stories that people were telling that, you know, you can. There are certainly other people, and some of them have filed civil lawsuits, you know, that allege that something similar happened to them.
And right? There's some history here. At one point, there was a discussion of mandatory training for people who are bouncers or security in these establishments, and. That sort of disappeared. Tell us about that.
I think that's what makes this interesting and kind of more than just a, you know, kind of a one-day crime story, which is, you know, we've had this discussion before. We had it in 2004 when, is it Gerald Hines or Haynes?
Hines.
When Gerald Hines died at Choku Charlie's in an encounter with a bouncer. So there's all this navel gazing after that. Well, you know, what do we know about these bouncers, and should they be trained? What kind of training do they have? Where's the line? Like, how far can they push it? You know, because certainly they're dealing with people who are drunk and are violent, you know, so they have to have some leeway. There was all that discussion at the time, and there was, I think, Alan Tesci, who was on the assembly at the time, was thinking of proposing some kind of rules, either a background check and training, or at least training. I know legislators were looking at that. And what happened at the time the liquor lobby said, "You know what? We got it. You don't need to pass any laws. We'll deal with it in house. You know, so we'll start our own
self-regulation.
We'll self-regulate. We'll have training for training for bouncers. Mm-hmm. We'll teach them how to bounce. You know, and we'll teach them how to And this is required in some other states. You know that you learn that you're trained that when someone's being violent, you de-escalate and you how to calm them. You know, you're like the dog whisperer with like." People who are drunk and violent, right? Right, yeah.
The drunk whisperer.
And so that training exists, but it's unclear to me whether anyone takes it. The security manager for Rum Runner says that Rum Runner's bouncers don't take it.
One of my friends is a very bright guy, said, and a witty guy, said that the really good bouncers convince you to leave and that it's your fault, and then you come back the next day and are glad they sent you home. I don't know if there are people who can do that, but I mean, there's a certain amount that goes into this that's convincing through verbal means is what I'm trying to emphasize here.
Right, and real quick, just to acknowledge that, again, I mean, the bar, I mean, they have their side of the story to tell, and that'll be told probably in court. They're not saying much right now, but if nothing else, there's also the issue of the background checks. And if you're a business owner, if you're a bar and you're trying to kind of defend yourself against these claims, I mean, one thing that puts you in a pickle is if your bouncers have a criminal record. In this case, the guy who got charged has a very extensive criminal record. He was being charged with crimes while he was in prison for other crimes, and just kind of was a career criminal. And so that doesn't help the cause, and that's another public policy thing that you would imagine would come out of something like this, where people would look at, you know, like just taxi drivers have to have criminal background checks, teachers' aides do too, you know, should bouncers have to have those?
Okay, once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Kyle Hopkins, Jill Burke, and Steve McDonald. Jill, the Fairbanks militiaman trial continues at the Anchorage Federal Courthouse. I've been attending, you've been attending. I know you haven't been attending on a regular basis, but you have been there this week and you've followed this story for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
What's the update here?
Well, I think we're 2 weeks into a trial that's projected to last maybe 4 to 6 weeks. So this is kind of really where the rubber meets the road of all of the allegations that we've heard about since the arrests were made in March of 2011. And we're, you know, these kind of character sketches are starting to emerge of these defendants, the men who are accused, Fairbanks
and
Militia.
And there are three of them.
Yeah, Fairbanks Militia leader Schaefer Cox and two of his followers, Coleman Barney and Lonnie Vernon. And, you know, to date, jurors have heard about the kinds of things that were found when the homes were searches, the weapons that were found, some of the activities that they were up to. And most recently, we started to hear about kind of Cox's big personality, his, you know, declarations that he was a sovereign citizen and that the laws of the land didn't describe to him, and some kind of attitude that he had where he could earnestly have diplomatic style relations between law enforcement in Fairbanks and himself and his militia. And you know, he was fairly brazen, I think, based on some of the more recent testimony that we've heard. A U.S. Customs and Border agent who was at a Walmart in line at a pharmacy with her little daughter by her side notices someone drifting up to her. She happened to be in uniform that day, which was unusual for her for a personal outing, but necessary because of the sick kid. And the guy from behind is Schaefer Cox in his trademark wool beanie cap. Kind of aggressive and confrontational, she felt, wanting to know who she was because she was in uniform and she was armed. And she explained who she was, and obviously he could see her name on her uniform. And then he went on to say something like, according to her, you know, well, we don't like too many feds in Fairbanks, but I'll, you know, you're okay because you're with Border Patrol. And came back a second time.
I run
time.
This town, lady.
Yeah, basically, you know, like you get the idea of, you know, kind of like the Wild Wild West almost. And you know, then he came back a second time and the conversation continued. And she later learned that her name was among a list of names of federal employees that were on kind of what is being presented to be an implied hit list or target list of people that Cox maybe was dissatisfied with. And so her name is on this. State troopers' names are on this. All of these.
Although, am I correct here? Didn't the defense go out of their way to point out that it wasn't clear who'd actually written up the
list?
That's
correct. Yes, and that's gonna come up. These are items that were found kind of collectively among these gentlemen's, you know, either homes or cars or in a storage trailer. So we don't know who the author is, but the presumption at this point is that it was something that was created in service to the militia, which was led by Cox and in service to kind of his goals or fears or needs.
And tell us about visit Cox made with his wife to Deputy Detachment Commander Wall at his home.
Right, so this is a second kind of second
of the troopers.
Strange episode related to Cox to someone else's whose name appeared on this, you know, handwritten list. So a trooper, high-ranking trooper in the area, who's actually the deputy commander when the regular commander's not around. He's a lieutenant. He knew Cox through association of actually being a neighbor at one point in time when Cox was still a younger man living at home with his parents. And then came to know Cox in an official capacity when Cox kind of became this rising political, you know, aspirant. And
spokesman for the Second Amendment.
Spokesman and creator of the Second Amendment Task Force, very staunch pro-gun rights, said, hey, I'd like to have a meeting with you, has this meeting with this officer. And it basically says, you know, declaring again that they won't stand for any encroachment on gun rights. And so you roll forward again. And in June of 2010, I believe, this trooper is at home in his new home, that's kind of in an isolated area, wooded hillside, notices Cox's car drive by with another van, thinks it's odd, makes note of it. He's also starting to feel like at times he's being followed. Another time he noticed somebody stopping at a gas station to take pictures of him. And then one day he's, you know, working, doing something and notices—
It's at dinner time.
It's at dinner time. Notice Cox, you know, driving up and approaching the house. He's a little freaked out. He doesn't let Cox know he's freaked out, but he sends the wife and kid upstairs, draws his weapon, runs into the garage, and takes cover behind a car. And you know, this certainly communicates that this was definitely alarming to this trooper. Cox shows up the situation de-escalates, and the trooper invites Cox in. It's like, okay, so let's sit down at the table, find out what you want. Turns out Cox was there to say, look, I've got this problem with OCS. I need help getting them off
their
back.
Office of Children's Services.
Office of Children's Services. And if troopers are summoned to get involved, I don't want troopers involved. I don't want troopers coming to my property. Cox is sitting across from him.
Explaining to him how it would be a terrible thing if any of them got hurt. Right.
I'll get to that in a minute. So Cox is sitting across from him in body armor, and it's just this strange scene. And the trooper testified that he really felt that Cox was there with dual purposes and dual intent. And this is part of the troubling aspect of Cox, I think, that jurors are going to have to make a decision about, which is Cox was kind of very glib. Hey, look, man, I've got this 3,500-man-strong militia. They're armed, but I can't control them. And if something bad happens to me, my kid, or my wife, blood might be shed. I don't want blood to be shed, but blood might be shed. And, you know, I'm begging of you, don't go down that road. And really the message that the trooper took away was, back off of me or else. He told the court that he went on to tell Cox he would hold Cox personally responsible if any harm did come to law enforcement, because Cox was responsible for the group's behavior.
One of the things that struck me, and I'm gonna use the word, it seemed fantastic to me in the sense of fantasy, is for Mr. Cox, you are going to a police officer's home, mm-hmm. who is the deputy detachment head. What do you think is going to happen when you're talking to him about potential violence?
Right.
He is going to call other police officers.
Right, and we know that, we haven't heard about this in court yet, but we know from the investigation that a short time later, they have undercover informants who are dispatched to infiltrate the militia and who are dispatched
to spy on
the militia.
Of that event.
Well, who knows?
But it's
June 2010, yeah. And suddenly you've got your, paid informants dialed in, and that same summer. So I think it's logical to assume that the alarm was raised, and certainly concern was piqued when Cox started talking about law enforcement being killed at the hands of a militia he couldn't control. Something else that I thought was interesting, and then I'll wrap up because I know we need
to move on.
No,
you're doing a great job. Go ahead.
Is that the trooper said that, he really felt like Cox's militia, Cox's actions weren't about gun rights, that it wasn't about an imploding government, that it wasn't about the Constitution, that this was all about Cox and protecting himself and his family, and that that's why he in particular was saying, look, you can say all you want that you're not in control of these guys, but this is by design, this is your own creation, and I'm going to hold you responsible.
Yeah, that was a very interesting part of his testimony, as he made that absolutely clear that that's what he believed in any case, mm-hmm. about this event. Okay, let's return to Kyle Hopkins. Kyle, Randy Redrick retires as chairman of the Alaska Republican Party. He's been in service for them for 12 years. You've been doing quite a bit of work on his tenure. Can you tell us something about Randy Redrick and his times?
I've been trying to understand what's happened over the past month with the Republican Party and, the role of the Ron Paul campaign and the Tea Party and stuff. But part of that story, I think, is, sometimes you talk about stories we've written or are going to write. But this is one almost, I just kind of want to, this is one I want told to me almost, which is the kind of the ballad of Randy Redrick as, Republican Party chairman over the past dozen years, right? Because if you think of, I use this analogy a lot, but if you think of Alaska politics as a TV show or soap opera or whatever, this guy, he's a recurring character. He's always coming back. Sometimes he kind of plays the villain. Sometimes, depending on what your persuasion is, but.
It's like a soap opera patriarch.
Yeah, he's just kind of his name is one of the first in the credits, right? And,
starring as Randy Redrick, Redrick.
So it's significant, it's significant because, the modern Alaska Republican Party has really been shaped by Randy Redrick, right? He kind of changed the job that the Ron Paul folks have now kind of taken control of. That was a different job before he had it. He was a retired engineer. He had time. It's not a paid job, so he was able to just kind of devote all his, but he was retired. He had some money, so he was able to just devote all his time to it. He also was pretty wonky about, just the nuts and bolts and the machinery of registering voters, and just really seemed into that. And the numbers show that, despite there's all these bumps along the way, right? There was, the ethics complaint from Sarah Palin. There was Joe Miller's ouster attempt in 2008. There's all the corruption trials, which he stayed at the head of the party during all this corruption trials. The time when you think that they would
say, and if I might, he by necessity had to be fairly close to Bill Allen because Allen was such a big donor, right?
Well, if you,
I mean, necessarily personally, but professionally.
Yeah. Well, that was there was in that group, kind of old guard group of Republicans, that was not a huge group of people, and certainly those guys would both be in it, right? That was Palin's big complaint when she's running for governor, was like, oh, there's, the good old boys, and I'm not one of them, but Ben Stevens is, and so is Randy. I just kind of wanted to know just the significance of him moving on. And anyone you talk to will say that he did plan on leaving, that he kind of stuck around.
His decision to leave was voluntary. Is that your best understanding?
That's what, as far as I know. I haven't heard anyone say convincingly otherwise.
That's my impression.
He's 68. Mm-hmm. He's done it for a long time. That's usually not a job. You do that job for a few years usually, and then you move on.
Right.
He said he stuck around through redistricting, And I guess to wrap up, the one example I'll give is just kind of like the kind of, his role is almost like the Karl Rove of Alaska Republican politics was, I was talking about redistricting and he's saying, I spent a lot of time working on that, especially over the last year. But when he talks about his work on redistricting, he's talking about, planting the seeds 6 years ago, like getting a Republican elected governor, getting a Republican, Senate president, and getting a Republican House Majority Speaker, all people who are going to appoint the members of the redistricting board. So this was someone who was playing chess a few, moves ahead.
Okay, thank you. Steve, you want to
just one thing.
Get in on this?
I, as a character, I really liked Randy Riedrich. He was always a hoot. I liked him as a guy. But he always reminded me of my analogy. The soap opera one was great. My analogy is Rick Swenson. When Rick Swenson dominated the Iditarod, no matter who was leading that race, the first question out of that musher's mouth when they got to a checkpoint was, where's Swenson? Well, you're ahead. Well, where's Swenson? Well, I think Democrats were the same way. They're just like, where's Randy Riedrich? Is anybody keeping an eye on Randy Riedrich? Because he was always, to them, lurking in the shadows, coming up with some, I think he just scared the daylights out of those guys. And Randy reveled in it. He loved
that.
Well,
they loved the job.
Oh, he did. He loved the job. I think that's why he stayed on for the 12 years. You're right. He loved it.
And although it's not paying, there are benefits to it in the sense that you get the applause of your fellow Republicans. Mm-hmm. You go to the National Republican Convention where I've seen him. I'm guessing you get your picture taken with the President of the United States. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Are very dignified people. You get great war stories, so there's our benefits.
But Kyle brought up the ethics complaint, and he was fined, I think, $12,000, more than $12,000. That was like a record. It still may be a record fine for an ethics complaint.
And the charge was using state time and state equipment.
Right. For political purposes. Yeah, right. And you would think, oh, my gosh, we got to boot this guy out of here. But no, they kept him. They kept him in there. There's a reason for it, I think.
Let's stick with Steve McDonald. Now we know there'll be layoffs in the Anchorage School District. The school district has made that decision. Tell us about those layoffs. And one of the things I think viewers wonder, I wonder, is why does every year seem to end the same way in layoffs for some members of the teaching and professional staff?
That's a great question, and it's all budgetary. There's 55 people who have been given pink slips. 35 of them are teachers. 20 of them are administrative support staff. Now, there's a possibility that all of these people could be brought back on, or at least a good number of them. The school district says there's about 35, 40 people who announced retirements or maybe leave the district during the course of the summertime. So they've had a history of bringing a lot of people who've been laid off in the spring back during the summer and getting ready for the fall again. This is due to budget restrictions for next year, and this is what the school district would tell you would be a major flaw in the way the schools are funded here in the state of Alaska. They don't really know what their funding is going to be until it's late in the school year. And they've got to make, there's always been a
call. The legislature meets in the late winter and spring. And
right. They don't know what the budget's going to be until the school year is pretty much over and you don't really know what you're going to have for the next year. It's hard to plan into the future when you're not sure what the funding is going to be. If funding sources remain flat, they would be facing, the district would be facing, the Anchorage School District would be facing like a $20 million shortfall for next year, but that would, that's under the worst case scenario.
I've got to get Jill in here for 1 minute. Yeah. Thank you, Steve. We have about 1 minute left. Jill, the Kodiak Naval Air Base suffered two murders. The FBI is still working on it. What do we know at the present time about the search for the perpetrator?
I don't think we know a whole lot. I mean, one of the things that's been strange is these calls for volunteers that have happened on the island to come out and use metal detectors to search for something undetermined, but just a call by the FBI, hey, come out, do the search, help us. We don't know if anything was found. We don't think it was. A second search was conducted, I believe, inside the building where these murders took place.
And they took place on the post, and they were both active servicemen,
correct,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's really something.
And so the most recent announcement from the FBI is that they are searching for a .44 caliber handgun. They want to know if something's been sold, traded, bought. Did anybody see it? So this would suggest that that gun or a gun of that caliber was perhaps used in these murders, but we don't really know for sure. And it's quite strange. You know, the FBI has reassured the public and Kodiak, this island, that they are fine and safe, and yet the killer is not named, and the killer is not, the alleged killer is not in custody. So
and
it's quite odd.
I have to reassure our audience, we're sorry to leave. We're out of time. See you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at AlaskaEdition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.